of the Park Horlick game. That tip-off is 7 p.m. And college basketball tonight, the Badgers take on number 6, Michigan State. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday, the 26th. Should be mostly sunny, windy, and mild for the morning hours, turning cloudy in the afternoon. High today, 49. Winds up to 35 miles per hour. Right now, wind from the southwest at 15. Sunshine, blue sky, 38 degrees Racine, 37 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient eating and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about an important new book called Your Score, an insider's secrets to understanding, controlling, and protecting your credit score. The author of the book, Anthony Davenport, knows a lot about what a credit report is. In fact, in some respects, he has worked on both teams or both sides of the aisle, if you will. But since 2010, has been working on behalf of borrowers and customers rather than working for lenders. He founded in 2010 a credit management firm that represents all kinds of different clients and helps people understand their credit score and perhaps just as important, understand the ways in which that credit score can be improved. This book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again called Your Score. Anthony Davenport, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So let's go into a little more detail on what I touched on in the introduction, namely that you have worked sort of both sides of the ball. I don't know if you were a football player at one point, but I think most people will understand the metaphor. But explain a little more clearly what you used to do and what you do now, and how both of those help you understand this whole business of the credit report and credit score.
Yeah, so I was a banker for 10 years. I started off at Bank of America, and then I went to work for Wells Fargo. And my job was to get people loans. And I kept seeing that people were not getting the best rates or getting the best programs because their credit score was a few points off or wasn't quite the profile that the lending institutions were looking for. So I began digging and saying, like, hey, how can I help people get the credit score that will get them the very best rate? They'll love me a lot more. They'll send me referrals and whatnot. And over time, I realized that I actually hated being a banker. I didn't like the process of dragging people through the mud to get these loans, but that I really enjoyed helping them understand their credit because people didn't know about this whole system, how it works. If you were to ask people how many credit cards should you have or what kind of balances they should have on their credit cards, you get a lot of blank stares. So I really dug in deep to learn how you can manage this whole process, how you can build, how you can repair, how you can protect your credit, because I found that there's just a ton of misinformation out there. And now I'm atoning for my sins as a banker for 10 years by helping consumers understand and control their credit from all walks of life, We work with about half our clients are professional athletes and entertainers, and the other half are just regular people that need some help, you know, getting a handle on this whole thing.
Right. And you point out at one point in the book that a lot of us who live more ordinary lives with more ordinary means might be kind of shocked to think that a well-paid professional athlete or a well-paid professional musician might be in some trouble when it comes to something like their credit report. I mean, with one presumes mountains of money in the bank. But as you point out, their situation can in fact be very, very complicated, and it's very, very easy for someone even in that kind of situation to get themselves into some trouble regarding their own credit profile.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. So what people don't understand is that even if you're rich, the banks are not bending to you. Their whole existence is about getting as much money from you as humanly possible. And they love the credit system the way that it is, the way that people don't understand what goes into it and are just kind of wandering around thinking, well, I make a lot of money, I pay my bills on time, so my credit must be good. But in reality, only 35% of your FICO score comes down to whether you pay your bills on time. So 65% of it has nothing to do with whether you pay your bills on time. So that's how people that, even if you're rich and you make a lot of money or you're famous, you can still get caught in the same trap as the rest of us because you don't know what that other 65% is, and there's a lot of misinformation about it. And the banks are not going to tell you how to play this game at all. They want you to be kept in the dark.
Before we go into a little more detail about exactly how one's credit report is put together, and for that matter, just how to read the thing, I wonder if you could expound on something that you say in the preface of the book, where you describe our current situation or landscape as a different world. That is a very different world from what it was, for instance, 25 or 30 years ago. How have things changed, and how and why have they changed?
So things really started to change during the Great Recession, when the whole banking industry started to collapse and change. The downside, there's a lot of downsides to it, but one of the biggest downsides is that the bank started using this as an opportunity to make changes and hurt consumers in ways that they didn't before. One of them is that they came up with something called risk-based pricing. Didn't really exist a whole lot before. So back when I was a mortgage banker, if you had a 620 FICO score, for example, you got the loan, and you got the loan at the same rate as someone who had a 700 score. They just gave you the rate. But since then, they started coming up with these tranches of every 20 points, you're now in a different bucket. And they can penalize you for not having the optimal score, which is a 740. So if you have a 700 score, that's pretty good. But a 740 score gets you a significantly better interest rate and better options and programs. So that's the biggest change in this whole thing, is that now credit scores are being dissected by every 20 points to give you a different rate. And the second biggest thing that's been going on is that now they're starting to use credit scores and credit reports for every aspect of life in the modern times. So if you want to get a job, 70% of employers are checking your credit. If you want to rent an apartment, they're obviously going to check it. If you're going to get a mortgage, a car loan, of course, and obviously credit cards. But now it's even being used for auto and home insurance. They're tying correlations between your credit score to whether or not your house is going to burn down and you're going to make a claim. And trust me, I don't know how they're justifying this, but it's another way of saying, hey, if you have a 600 score, we're going to make you pay more for this than if you have an immaculate 740 or higher score.
I think it says a lot about this topic that we're talking about, that there's a whole section in your book that is devoted to just helping people read their credit report or credit score and understand what's there. That really, in a nutshell, kind of tells us that this is a relatively complicated business. Let's talk first of all about what a typical credit report and credit score looks like, and then and how such a credit report is put together.
Well, I'll start by telling you where you can get the same credit report that lending institutions use. Most people assume that the reports that they're getting from Credit Karma or Credit Sesame, or even directly from the credit bureaus themselves, are the most accurate ones and the same one that lending institutions use. But in reality, each of the three bureaus quietly paid fines of $25 million last year because they were selling these bogus credit reports to people and telling them that's the same thing that lending institutions use. So I'll tell you a website that they don't like you to know about, but it's where you can get the same credit report that lending institutions use to assess what your rate is and whether you're going to get a loan. It is www.itdoesntfriggin'exist.com. And it's because they don't want you to know how this whole thing works. They really don't. And if you were to go and ask your banker, hey, can I get a copy of my credit report that you guys are looking at? They're going to tell you, no, it's their bank policy not to give you that report. So one of the reasons why we dedicate so much of one chapter just to deciphering a credit report is because in it, we tell you how to get the actual real deal report. And then we have to tell you how to read it because it doesn't look at all like the cute and bubbly reports that you can get from any of the consumer sites. And the scores are different, so they don't give you the same score that the banks are looking at. So we tell you where to read it, how they're deciphering it, which one they're using. And I mean, that's why there's so much into this whole thing, is because you got to know how to read the real deal, not just the fake one that you're getting from these other bogus sites.
Why is it that the powers that be would not want us to be able to understand and appreciate our own credit reports? I mean, what is their motivation?
Money. If you don't know how this game is played, they're going to make more money off of you. And the average American has just under a 700 credit score nationwide. And that's not bad, but if you look at how much more you are paying in interest for your car loan, for your mortgage, for your credit cards and insurance policies by having an average credit score versus a 740 A+, it adds up to several hundred thousand dollars in interest over your life. That's a lot of money. And you're not necessarily a bigger risk by being a 700 versus a 740, but they know they can make as much money off of you as possible, so they will.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Davenport, talking about his book, Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. So there are a couple of things that the typical consumer needs to be concerned about, and one of them is that in some cases our credit score is a relatively accurate reflection of who we are and what we've done financially and what our financial state is. And sometimes that credit report and credit score is rife with inaccuracies of one kind or another. So let's start there. How do inaccuracies typically enter one's credit report? And how is one to even detect the presence of inaccuracies and correct them?
Well, I'll start with how to detect them. You need to check your credit on a regular basis, and you should start by getting one of the real credit reports, seeing what's really on there. Now, as far as how inaccuracies come up, you have to remember that the credit bureaus, their sole job is to collect data on you and then sell it. That is how they make their money. You as a consumer are not a priority, and you're not a client of theirs. The banks and lending institutions that are reporting to them and paying them, those are the clients. So as a result, they're not really spending time, effort, and energy into making sure that the data that they're getting is correct. And in fact, in many cases, they're tying something to you by not verifying your full name, not verifying your address, not verifying your full social. They will only take like the first couple letters of your name and then a couple digits of your social and then maybe the city that you live in. And then they're saying that's good enough to tie it to this person. So, you know, 60 Minutes did a great piece called 40 Million Mistakes, and that's their assessment from a congressional review that said 40 million Americans have mistakes on their credit report. And the reason why is because the credit bureaus don't really care. They're not paid to care. And they're not really going to help you resolve this sort of thing because it's not in their interest.
So when it comes to elevating one's own credit score, at one point when you're kind of talking about this in the chapter titled Building the Perfect Credit Profile, you talk about one particular matter that should be addressed, and then you say, this is just one part of the beauty pageant. I love that choice of words that, you know, in a sense, one is trying to beautify oneself and beautify sort of one's public face when it comes to financial matters. So when someone has a credit score that is not what it needs to be, particularly if some kind of important transaction is coming up in their life, what are at least a couple of things that they need to think about in terms of addressing that issue?
So I always recommend that 90 days before you're going to apply for a loan, if not sooner, you need to obtain a copy of the real report that they're going to be looking at. And then you need to assess what ways you can use to improve it. And we even mentioned like there's a, you know, like a 90-day slam plan, essentially, if you need to do something quick, fast, and in a hurry. But I'll tell you one tip that's in there. People don't understand that credit card balances impact your FICO score to the tune of 30%, which is nearly as much as whether you pay your bills on time. And if you pay off your balances in full each month, you probably assume that you're good, but that's not accurate because the lending institutions only report to the credit bureaus typically every 30 to 45 days. So if you're going to apply for some financing, zero out or pay down your credit card balances as much as possible. Refrain from using them until after you get the mortgage or a loan that you're applying for. And that can boost your credit score by nearly as much as if you removed a whole bunch of late payments.
What is the difference between improving one's financial situation, the reality, versus changing the appearance of that financial situation? I think that's kind of a complicated question. I'm not asking it very elegantly, but I hope you can kind of understand what I'm getting at. I mean, one thing is about sort of appearances, and the other is about the reality of one's life and how you are handling your money. And I suspect that you're really talking about both things here.
Yeah, really, because the whole credit system is not an accurate gauge of whether you're going to pay someone back or not. In other countries, they look at, and this is going to shock you, but it's going to look at how much money you make, how much money you save, and where you keep your money. And that's what they determine whether you're going to get a loan. But here, we care so much about your score more than anything else that it is kind of a beauty pageant. And you need to make sure that you look as pretty as possible before you're going to get that loan. And the credit score is not super good at being indicative of whether you're going to pay a loan back. The difference between someone who has a 720 score and a 740 score defaulting is negligible. Not going to happen, really. There's really not a difference. But if you know how to make sure that your credit score is as high as possible, it can save you thousands of dollars for almost each type of transaction you're going to do that is credit score based.
By the way, you have a whole chapter that is devoted to the newbie. That is someone who is about to establish credit for the very, very first time. And for some of us, that's a now long distant memory. But it's possible that there might be somebody listening for whom that is going to be a reality in the very, very near future. In a nutshell, what should somebody in that situation be thinking about?
So you have to start thinking about the fact that lending institutions now are very much against lending to someone who doesn't have a proven track record. And that's something that's new since the recession. They used to give out credit to anyone who wanted it. But if you have, like, young kids that are, you know, turning 18, you know, they need to start establishing their credit early before they intend on using it, because credit and debt is going to be a major part of their lives. And they have to start thinking of how they want it to look. How can you help your kids build credit? And one of those ways is to add them as an authorized user, we call it, which will show the same length of credit history on the newbie's credit report as it will, you know, from the person who originally opened it. So, for example, when I went to college, my parents gave me a credit card and added me as an authorized user. On my credit report, it looked like I had a credit card since I was 2 years old. Like, I'd been managing credit wisely since, you know, I was in diapers. And that's a real powerful way to help people kind of get into the game. And that's, you know, why we dedicated a whole chapter to that, because it may not apply to everyone, but odds are if they have kids, they're going to have to go through the system at some point in time.
Right. That takes us to a nice place to finish, namely that this is a matter that is important to all of us, even though I think a lot of people go through much of life relatively oblivious to this, not realizing how this can matter, even outside of the major transactions for which, you know, always bring one's credit score immediately to mind. Remind our listeners why this should matter to all of us.
Should matter to all of us because we all have a credit profile, and none of us have been taught the right ways in which to manage or protect it. And if you don't pay attention to this, you may assume that just because you pay your bills on time, your credit's great. But in reality, you may just have the average credit profile, and it will cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars over your lifetime by not actively managing this.
The book, again, is Your Score, An Insider's Secrets to Understanding, Controlling, and Protecting Your Credit Score. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author Anthony Davenport. Anthony Davenport, thank you for taking the time for this interview, and thank you for writing such a fascinating book.
Thank you so much for having me.
The time is 8:33. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program.
I always enjoy the opportunity to come to understand the meaning of words more thoroughly and more completely. And that is one of the pleasures in reading a new book called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World, a book which helps us understand in much more comprehensive fashion what is meant by terms like imagination, creativity, innovation. Those are terms which many of us, most of us probably, use pretty much interchangeably. But they each play a really important role, a crucial role, in successful entrepreneurship in this modern world in which we all live and try to function and succeed. And the author of this book, Insight Out, is Dr. Tina Selig. She earned a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford University Medical School and is now professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford School of Engineering, and also executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. So for many years now, she has been working with young people to help them understand and then harness their own creative ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. She is responsible for a
previous bestseller called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and another book called Ingenious, a Crash Course on Creativity. And this newest book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And Professor Tina Seelig, we welcome you to the morning show.
Wow, that was such a fabulous introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. And this is a great book. I have really enjoyed exploring it on a couple of different levels. I wonder if we could start with the rather personal note on which the book begins, with the story you relate of coming across a letter which you yourself had, in effect, written to yourself 30 years earlier.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing story. I mean, really, somebody couldn't have made this up. I wrote this book called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and soon after it came out, I got an email from an old friend I hadn't seen since I was a teenager, and he said, gosh, you know, is this the same Tina Seelig? We went to camp together when we were kids. And so I thought, wow, of course. And I knew that he had sent me a bunch of letters in those days when we actually wrote letters, you know, on paper. So I went through a big box of letters my parents had sent to me when they moved, and I found the letters he wrote. But more interesting, I stumbled upon one letter I had written to myself on the eve of my 20th birthday. Now, you realize I'd written this book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and all of a sudden this letter from 30 years earlier on the eve of my 20th birthday pops into my hand. And the letter basically said, I'm completely lost. I don't know what I'm doing. I have such huge dreams for myself. I have no idea how to get from where I am now to where I want to be. And I could feel that every day now teaching at Stanford, the same thing in my students. The idea that they have such incredible aspirations, and I felt like it was my responsibility to think about how do you actually get your ideas out of your head and into the world? How do you go through that process? And even after years teaching this topic, I realized that there were a lot of miscommunications and wanted to put a stake in the ground that was going to help other people make their dreams come true and sort of live the lives that they dream to live.
I really appreciated something that you said about the way in which at least much of formal education tends to fail its students. And I'm applauding that as someone who happens to teach at a college as my full-time job. So I'm in the trenches with you, but I see this happen, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself. You say at one point, unfortunately, most formal education deals with memorization as opposed to innovation. It focuses on learning about heroes as opposed to teaching students to be heroic. And it presents problems with one right answer as opposed to real-life challenges with an endless number of viable solutions. Here's my favorite line. People should emerge from school with agency, feeling empowered to address the opportunities and challenges that await them. I guess what you're saying is you came to realize in a clearer way your responsibility as a college professor to offer that up to your students.
Exactly. Well, you know, we live in a very different world than our education was designed for, right? It was designed before there was books and the internet, and, you know, people had to get up and lecture to transmit information. But information is a commodity now. We can all find out this information. And the world is changing so fast. It really is our responsibility to teach people, A, how to learn, and how to tap into their passions, so that they can solve the problems that they really want to solve. The world is filled with lots of challenges, and we really need to prepare people to address them, you know, whether they're the individual challenges in their own life to the challenges that, you know, face the planet.
Hmm. Before we start talking about your book a little more specifically, I wonder if you could say a word about this thing called the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. I suspect that the whole reason for its existence folds nicely into what we are going to be talking about today.
Great. Yeah. So I'm fortunate enough to be the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. This is a program I helped build over the last 16 years. And essentially, our philosophy is this. We're in the School of Engineering at Stanford. And the philosophy is that it's no longer good enough for students to come out of school with a purely technical training. They need to understand the entrepreneurial world in which they're going to be working, whether they're individual contributors, running a team, leading an organization, or even starting a company. They need to know how to put together effective teams, They need to know how to lead. They need to know how to negotiate. They need to know how to be creative problem solvers. In fact, to be honest, we say that teaching entrepreneurship is a Trojan horse for teaching very, very important life skills. These skills are important no matter what you do, and you can be entrepreneurial in everything you do.
I guess that's a really great place for us to start, because actually I think that is really crucial to us even being able to take in a lot of the ideas that you share here, because I think the idea of being an entrepreneur or entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial skills, that's a term that we tend to think of fairly restrictively. And I, for one, have never used that term in describing anything that I do in my very busy, complex life. And in fact, in the way that you're using this term, it's a term we should not be scared of, and we should readily apply to ourselves, even if we've never done that before. Explain how we can open up this our sense of what it means to be entrepreneurial and why we should do that.
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. If you came to our offices at Stanford, painted on the wall in very big letters, it says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. And that is the core of what it means to be entrepreneurial. It means seizing opportunities, leveraging resources, making things happen. I am sure you do that every single day in your life. And if you understand that you're an entrepreneur, it gives you that mindset that really you are a problem solver. It's interesting. We had a brand new dean, and she's fabulous, who just started in the School of Engineering, and she's a physicist, quite talented. And at first she came in and was sort of allergic to the term entrepreneurship. I mean, she was very, very actively saying, I don't like this word. And she went and talked with every single faculty member in the School of Engineering at Stanford. That's hundreds of people. And she, at the end, said, I've changed my mind. I understand now that entrepreneurship is about problem solving, and that that's what we do here. And that is core to the philosophy and the approach that we have here. And so it's something that is super important for everyone to embrace, from young kids to anyone, you know, of any age, that they too can address the challenges around them and come up with really, really creative solutions.
I appreciate how you take this apart in the first chapter of the book, saying that there are three elements to the entrepreneurial mind, that you need to see the world as opportunity-rich, you need to have a specific set of tools for solving problems, and each of those was addressed in earlier books. And this book really points to that third element, which is crucial to successful entrepreneurship, moving from inspiration to implementation.
Yeah, so I didn't realize until I got to the end that this book was the third part of the trilogy. Now, the book's going to certainly be read in any order. They're not designed to be read 1, 2, 3. But what I wish I knew when I was 20 is really about having an entrepreneurial mindset, about seeing the world as opportunity rich. Ingenious is really, you get to walk right into my classroom, and it's all about the tools I teach about creativity and innovation. That book's called Ingenious. And this book really weaves them both together and shows the relationship between your attitudes and your actions. And essentially, I walk people through this invention cycle, going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship, showing the attitudes and actions that have to happen along the way to really bring your ideas to life.
As you are introducing us to this concept, one of the things you do is help us understand the background behind the phrase thinking outside the box, which a lot of us use rather carelessly. And it's so interesting to know exactly the origins of this phrase. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I personally am not a fan of that phrase. And in fact, most of the people I know who teach creativity aren't either. Because it's used as a catch-all. It's used as a cliche. You know, if I ask people, hey, what does creativity mean to you? They go, well, thinking outside the box. I said, well, what does that mean? And it turns out that term comes from the old puzzle that you might be familiar with, where you have nine dots, you know, rows of three dots, and your goal is to create, to connect all the dots using lines, four or fewer lines, without taking the pen off the paper. And the only way to actually do that is to draw beyond the frame, the invisible frame of that box, to allow the lines to connect. And that's where the term thinking outside the box comes from. Now, most people don't know that, and so when they even say it, they don't even know what that means. So I really challenge people to think much more systematically about what it means to be creative and what tools you actually need to make that happen.
Right after you explain the origins of the phrase, you use another phrase which I find really intriguing. And it's really the point of your whole book, but I sort of love the way these words kind of frame this in a way that is kind of maybe surprising to us. You're saying, in reality, creativity requires a complex set of skills, attitudes, and actions. I mean, much more important than thinking outside the box would suggest. Intimately related to imagination, innovation, and entrepreneurship. Here's the part I love. To harness our creativity, we need a robust set of definitions for all parts of the creative and entrepreneurial mm-hmm. process.
Right.
But I think that's so intriguing. I think most of us, when we think about creativity, think of it as something that, by its very nature, needs to be unleashed and not harnessed or limited in any way. And, of course, in a sense, that kind of creativity is so aimless that it ends up maybe accomplishing nothing or very little. And this notion of harnessing creativity for a productive end, that's really valuable, and probably especially valuable for people that we immediately and most obviously think of as being creative.
But think about it. We harness our physical abilities when we become an athlete, or our artistic abilities when we become, you know, a painter, or our musical abilities. You know, we have all of these innate abilities, and yet if they're not used and harnessed, we don't have a coach, we don't have someone who's going to help us really use our muscles the right way and to look at things in a very thoughtful way as an artist, we end up being very sloppy. And the same thing is true with creativity. With a framework, with a set of tools, you can really focus your abilities and make yourself stronger. I mean, just as if I exercise, I make my muscles stronger. If I use my creativity in a very thoughtful way, I get stronger at that as well.
Absolutely. And towards that end, this book then really helps us sort of understand this whole process.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Right. So you craft something which you call at one point a scaffolding of skills, which is important here. And it helps us distinguish between terms which you yourself say you've often used indiscriminately, as though they're pretty much the same thing. And the longer you have explored this, the more you realize that these terms are each distinct from the other. The terms are imagination leads to creativity, creativity to innovation, innovation to entrepreneurship. But we need to make sure we're really clear about imagination, creativity, innovation, and how they are each their own unique step in this process.
Yeah, and this is really important. And you bring up the fact that I do admit that for years I used the words interchangeably. You know, people conflate the words imagination and creativity. You know, they use them interchangeably, or creativity and innovation. But I realized that's a huge missed opportunity. So the framework that I create is very simple, and I wanted it to be simple so that it's easy to remember and then easy to harness. So the idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't yet exist. Pretty simple, right? It's something we do all the time. Okay? Creativity is applying our imagination to address a challenge. But we might be coming up with a solution that's been invented before. That's fine. It's new to me. It might not be new to the world. Innovation, though, is applying that creativity to come up with really unique solutions, things that are unique to the world. And entrepreneurship is applying your innovation to bring the invention of whatever sort to the rest of the world. Now, at each step along the way, there's a set of actions and attitudes that are required to get you to the next step. I liken this to the process of learning to talk, right? We start out with sounds we make. We apply those sounds to make words, apply those words to make sentences, and those sentences to make stories. And that same sort of hierarchy applies when going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship.
Hmm. I think as I glanced at your book the first time, the part that was maybe the most surprising to me was trying to take apart something like imagination. Because I think most of us, when we think about imagination and being imaginative, we think of that as something that, you know, maybe we have it or we don't. I mean, an entirely innate ability that some people have in great quantities and others seem to scarcely have any imagination at all. But generally speaking, I think most of us think of it as something that either you have it or you don't, like you're a blonde or you're a brunette. And of course,
I guess you can change that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, no kidding. But you really help us understand that imagination is a tool that can be fostered and nurtured just like anything else.
You bet. In fact, there's some interesting surprises in this. When I started digging into it, I realized, you know, most people think about that their imagination is something that you just sit around with your eyes closed under a tree and you're imaginative. Well, that's one way to do it. But really, most great ideas come from starting with a set of data. The more experiences you have in the world, the more you have to work with, because your imagination is essentially connecting, combining things that already are in your mind. This is why people who live in very enriched environments can have much more rich imagination than those who grow up in a very limited environment. And so the more engaged you are in the world and the more really active engagement, paying attention, listening better, watching better, you know, feeling things more deeply, the more you have to work with and the more you can envision what might be different. In fact, it's critically important to realize that our passions, our ideas about what could be, are designed after we're engaged. Before it's your passion, it's probably something you know nothing about. And this is really important because you can do anything from waiting tables to taking a trip around the world, and those experiences are going to really light up opportunities.
Hmm. So one of the steps you lay out is the importance of moving from engaging in the world with the world in a fashion that fosters our own curiosity to this idea of then envisioning. And this is probably an important step that a lot of us don't fully appreciate.
Yes. As I just mentioned, right, you engage first and then you envision what might be different. You know, your passions and the things that you care about follow that engagement. I tell a number of stories in the book of people who are going about their lives in a very expected way, and then something happens to them that triggers their motivation to do something differently and to solve a problem.
Hmm.
And that can happen to any of us. If we're actually paying attention, we start seeing places where we really can make a difference and address the challenges that are around us.
I appreciated how you help explain why this envisioning skill sometimes erodes over time. You write at one point, the ability to visualize is critically important for imagination. Unfortunately, as we get older, most of us aren't encouraged to practice this skill. Beyond childhood, we stop telling imaginative stories ourselves and focus instead on reading other people's fiction. We stop making artwork and begin looking at other people's creations. I guess one of the reasons this leapt out at me is because my full-time job happens to be teaching music in a college setting, and my wife is a music teacher. And it seems like there are a lot of forces at play in the world which are all about maybe the STEM areas of study, mm-hmm. and in particular also you know, business and management and so on, important areas of discipline of study which can sometimes crowd out the arts. And you are writing here in a way which suggests that that there is a very important place for that kind of study, if for no other reason in just fostering your ability to be creative and imaginative in other arenas in your life.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I was at an art show last night. A friend of mine was displaying some artwork, and I went up to one of the paintings, and it said, you know, artist and the name of the artist. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Does that person define themselves as an artist? Does that mean that I'm not an artist? Right? I'm a musician, artist, writer. Well, I'm a writer. You know why I'm a writer? Because I write. You know, you're an artist if you actually pick up a paintbrush or, you know, some clay. You're a musician if I could, you know, bang some pots together and start making music. I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, but I feel as though by labeling people in this way, it means that the other people label themselves as not that, right? I'm not an artist. I'm not a musician. I'm not a writer. But, of course, we all have these skills. And I really am a huge believer that these are things we should be baking into our lives in all different ways. Yes, I might not be painting all the time, but to know that that's something I could do, you know, I could pick up a paintbrush and express myself that way. Why not?
Absolutely. And, of course, it's only when you're given those opportunities and the invitation and the encouragement to do so that you might even discover creative outlets you didn't even know were there. And,
exactly.
And who knows the ways in which they might be applied, particularly when we get good at this thing called reframing, which you talk about a little later in the book. But one of the most important things that one can do in bringing about innovations and successfully bringing them to the world is not being stuck in the same framework of the present.
Yeah, I spend most of my time teaching. This is what I focus on, is how do you reframe problems? How do you look at a problem from very different angles to come up with really different solutions? I'll give you just a really simple example. Let's imagine we were a friend of ours was having a birthday, and we were going to brainstorm about a birthday party. Let's have a birthday party, and let's come up with ideas. If we change one word in that prompt from let's plan a birthday party to let's plan a birthday celebration, we've now opened up the frame of possibilities. The question you ask is the frame into which the answer will fall. So if you don't ask the question properly at the beginning, you're not going to get as rich a set of solutions.
Right.
And so by just thinking about looking at the problem you're trying to solve in really different ways, subtle to very bold new perspectives, you end up coming with really, really different solutions.
One of my favorite moments in the book that speaks to that is where you had a various teams in one of your classes engaging in brainstorming, and one of the teams was supposed to rethink movie theaters, and
mm-hmm.
They came up with all kinds of interesting ideas, including one in which maybe people, while they're watching a movie, would all be on stationary bicycles. I mean, getting their exercise while they watch this this two-hour movie. I mean, what a fabulous idea. But if the framing of the question was such that the task was to take present-day movie theaters and do what they do just a little better or come out ahead of their competitors, that leaves you stuck in the original frame. But when the question is framed in such a way that you can envision an entirely different kind of movie theater.
Right.
I mean, it's just thrilling to think about the possibilities that, in a sense, are out there just waiting to be discovered or thought of.
Right. That was part of an exercise where I have the students unpack all the assumptions about something. So that was part of all the assumptions of a movie theater or the assumptions of a fast food restaurant or the assumptions about airline travel or hotels. You can pick whatever topic you want. You unpack all your assumptions, and then you turn them upside down. So one of the assumptions was, of course, that you're sitting there quietly, and they questioned that and said, gee, what if we ended up, you know, sort of combining a spin class with a movie theater, and you had sort of a spin class where you're watching a movie, and one of their ideas was you pay at the end, right? If you end up, the more exercise you do, the less you pay for the movie. So the idea is that you actually have an incentive, even a financial incentive, to get more exercise.
Hmm. Well, there's a whole lot more to be discovered in this wonderful book, which takes us all the way through this cycle, including all kinds of important insights on what it means to take this to that that stage then of entrepreneurship and of persisting through barriers to bring an innovative idea to full fruition. The book again is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. It's published by HarperCollins, and the author, Tina Selig. Professor Selig, this was a great pleasure for me to read your book and to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Next week on The Morning Show Monday, we look forward to a visit from Chris Paulson from the Racine Heritage Museum, talking about some exciting things in their future, including a really big fundraiser that's coming up, and also about
all that the Racine Heritage Museum has to offer from their amazing collection. Also next week, a little later in the week, we'll be talking with Dan Joyce from the Kenosha Public Museum about an exhibit that they have there right now, which is about intriguing works of art around the theme of death. Also next week, among other things, I'm excited to share with you my conversation with Bryant Johnson, who is the personal trainer of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is, of course, a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And next week, we'll also include a conversation with Jessica Fellows, her uncle Julian Fellows,